The reading which Cooper did is the last of the Sermon on the Mount. And it speaks about where we would build our house. In some ways reflects the language of the 128th Psalm, which says, except the Lord build a house, except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. And so tonight I want to talk with you for a while about homes built on a rock. A friend of mine once had an automobile that had an oil leak. Took it to the mechanic, expecting him to say, well, that can be repaired easily. And he said, you need the whole engine overhauled. And in some ways, people with problems in the family need an engine overhaul. It's not just a small, inconsequential problem, easily repaired. But the foundation of the home is not strong. So I want to deal with that some tonight. I'm sure that if you 10 minutes a day or $50 a month paid to some counselor would be sufficient to repair all that was lacking, that would be done. But it'll take a great deal more than that. I think we expect to be swept along by emotions not of our own making that will secure the home in such steadfastness and security that we'll hardly have to make any investment at all. The truth is you'll have to make a very radical investment if you want to have a happy home. And to young people who have not yet married, I want to tell you ahead of time that you must prepare yourselves now for that kind of investment and that kind of commitment that's going to be required. To accomplish what you may see and observe in the lives of some older Christians, and you say you wish that you could have a marriage like that, then it's entirely possible, but you will have to make considerable sacrifice in order to achieve that. Homes of the past were not built upon skill in the science of home and marriage. People that knew all the latest thing about how male and female interact, and who use those dynamics which they are now familiar with because of the social sciences to guide us in the building of our homes. Homes at last are built upon the rock that Jesus speaks of in the 7th chapter of Matthew at the conclusion of his Sermon on the Mount. I want to talk to you about what it means to build a house on a rock. First of all, Matthew chapter 5 in the attitude of the beatitude is what you're going to have. And you'll notice there that the attitude of the beatitudes is that of humility, an awareness of one's own deep failures and need, a disposition to be merciful to others. It's obvious in those 8 great statements that one's attitude toward God is one of submission. One's attitude toward others is one of selfless love. And if you're not ready for that task, then you will not build a house on the rock. You will build it on the sand. And when the storm comes, it will collapse. Let me take up this important section. It begins verse 20 of the 5th chapter of Matthew. As he continues his sermon, he says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." And you say, "I thought this was about marriage." It is about marriage. And if you are married, it's about the kingdom of heaven too. So the two are linked together. But what kind of righteousness do you want? Do you want this kind of superficial, external righteousness, outward righteousness? Or do you want what Jesus is going to speak of in the rest of this chapter, inward righteousness? In the 21st chapter, he contrasts murder with bitter attitudes and words, bitter attitudes and words. Somebody says, I'm not going to murder my wife. And I don't intend to murder my husband, although I've heard it said, humor said, don't intend to get a divorce, I may murder. But not divorce, but some of that humor touches a little too close to serious things. And you may not ever murder your husband or your wife, although it looks like it's happening all around us. But I can tell you, you'll slaughter them good with bitter words and bitter attitudes. Proverbs 15:1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath. But what kind of answer do we give our marriage mates if they do anything, say anything to irritate us? Here's back at you. Here's something to tell you, I don't take that kind of attitude. I don't take that kind of behavior. I don't accept it from anybody, and I don't accept it from you. Isn't it interesting what goes on within the inner sanctum of marriages that would absolutely be horrifying if it were done to other people? A soft answer turns away wrath, but bitter words stir up strife. And so, in spite of the fact that we know and understand the truth of that principle, we go on with that same disposition to return in kind, and when somebody puts a stick of wood on the fire, we put three or four more. A soft answer turns away wrath. You don't have to answer words that are intended to hurt with words that are intended to return in kind. You don't have to do that. Indeed, if you do that, you'll be guilty of exactly what he's talking about here. And so far as Jesus is concerned, it's equivalent to murder. He that hates his brother in his heart is a murderer, says John in 1 John chapter 3, verse 15. And we know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. So if I have that disposition to strike at the heart of my mate with bitter words, what is being said here in this text and in the rest of the New Testament context is that you are a murderer and eternal life is not going to abide in you. Build your house on a rock. And avoid that kind of thing because it destroys relationships. And may I add what he also goes on to say in that particular section, that is, if you come to offer your gift at the altar and you remember that your brother has something against you, you go and be reconciled to your brother. So reconciliation with your marriage mate, as with any other person, is essential before you come here to worship. If you come here to worship with hard feelings in your heart about your marriage mate, unreconciled, words that have sliced and diced and cut in every direction, then your worship is in vain. Meaningless. You're wasting your time. We must be reconciled to each other before we can worship God together. Isn't that what Peter says in 1 Peter 3, verse 7? That we're husbands to live with our wives according to knowledge and understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel. That your prayers be not what? That your prayers be not hindered. Which is simply to say that if we treat each other in this fashion and make no effort to correct it, do not ask the person we have wronged, please don't say, but they did worse, who cares? This is what you have done, and you make no effort to correct your fault, then your prayers to God remain unanswered. Secondly, he contrasts adultery and lust. Verse 27, you've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. We have altogether too much what is now called soft pornography. It used to be hard pornography. It used to be XXX. That's what it was 20, 30 years ago. But now it's a soft pornography. The soft pornography of television programs, of magazines, and not only that, but he says the hand must be careful too. Too much familiarity and touching is not wise. Therefore, we have to be discreet among ourselves when we are with others who are our close friends. Couples get close to each other. That's altogether right. But the closeness that they have toward each other must not cross the bounds of propriety. Did you know, you already know, that adultery is committed often with the best friend of your spouse? Because there is the greatest opportunity. And so, we control the eye. As he says in this particular text, it's better to pluck the eye out. It's better to cut off the hand. And what he's saying there is, whatever it takes to excise this disposition, attitude from your heart, you need to take it. However painful it is, it's got to be taken. What you need to quit looking at, what you need to quit participating in, what you need to quit exposing yourself to, must be done. Just like that. And he said, cut it off and throw it from you. Decisive action. So as spouses, as those committed to each other, we are not allowed by God to have these thoughts that run and range about in adulterous kind of speculations. So the issue here is, are we willing to be Christians in our relationship with our marriage mate? In chapter 5, verse 31, he talks about divorce. And he says, whoever divorces his wife, it has been said, let him give her a certificate of divorce. That's all you need to be concerned about. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. I've said about the brethren that although we oppose the divorce in marriage, we sort of are disposed to do it in local churches. We don't want to try to be reconciled. We want to get a divorce. I want to be out of here. It's a lot more pleasant just to get out of here and get away from you than it is to deal with the problem and be reconciled. But with regard to marriage, the commitment that's made in it is a very sacred one. You commit yourself to someone else as long as we both shall live. And that other person depends on you and rests his or her hope on you, trusts you, opens himself or herself up to you, and then one day you say, I don't want to be married anymore. I don't like being married. And I don't like being married to you. I have no interest in anybody else, but I just don't want this anymore. Jesus said, when you put away a wife for a cause other than sexual immorality, you make her an adulteress, and whoever marries her an adulteress, it is presumed in this instance that a marriage will ensue. Is there any love in that? Where's the love? I just don't want to be married anymore. It's unpleasant to be married to you. I married you, but I don't want to be married anymore. When a problem comes, solve it. That's the expectation of the Lord. Don't run from the problems. If two young people were shipwrecked on a desert island and were there for years and years without any hope of rescue, and they decided without benefit of clergy, because there's nothing there, that they would be joined together, do you think a divorce would occur? Who else would there be? So what is being suggested here is that you put yourself on a desert island with your mate. Because this is the one, and with this one I must be reconciled, and this relationship has got to be healed, because there's not going to be any other relationship, and I have the obligation, because I have made a commitment, to keep myself to her, to him alone, as long as we both shall live. That's the way it is. Then Jesus takes up the question of perjury versus deception in the next section. Again, he says, verse 33, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black, but let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Here are the people concerned about perjury, and Jesus is concerned about honesty and truth. There's a lot of dishonesty in marriage relationship. We don't tell each other the truth. This is a simple illustration. Your wife comes in, face is rather cloudy. How you doing? Fine. Doing fine. She's not doing fine. You're not doing fine at all. But you press the matter. No. What's wrong? Nothing. Nothing wrong. And you can turn it around. There's dishonesty in that. There's a refusal to openly declare that you have hurt me. Or I felt hurt by something you've done. And if you do not do that, then this problem is not going to be solved. And there are other occasions, you know, that are a little more blatant. Where were you last night? Working at the office? You weren't at the office. You were out playing some game with the boys. Whatever. Anytime you do not tell the truth to your spouse, you destroy credibility and trust, and that is the foundation of any relationship. Trust. The ability I have to know that if you ever tell me something, that's the way it is. And I won't tell you something when you don't tell the truth about something. That needs to be corrected as quickly as you can do it. Because damage will be done as a consequence of it being found out that you didn't tell the whole truth. And that's a breach in the relationship. Don't ever lie to your marriage mate. Let me say that again. Do not ever lie to your marriage mate. Absolute honesty is the rule. That's the Lord's rule. It's essential to all relationships. Then, verse 38. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. The law of retaliation. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him two. And give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. What is the rule here? Although it's stated in a very dramatic way. The rule is, you do not return evil for evil. But I have endured so much. You have no idea what I've put up with. The Lord doesn't seem to be concerned about that. And you ought not to be thinking that way. But I've endured this for several years. Well, bless your poor heart. You ought not to return evil for evil. When you return evil for evil, you get some more evil back. And the fire will spread. And the bitterness will deepen. And you wonder why things are getting worse. And there can be social retaliation, you know, kind of withdrawal. Don't say a word, but just kind of withdraw. Turn into a moving thundercloud, you know. Nothing's happened yet, but it's obvious. Attitude's not right. Sexual retaliation. That is sinful. And not acceptable in a marriage relationship. And then the thing at last in this chapter, which really brings home the foundation of all relationships, and in marriage in particular, he says in verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those that curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. Now, this text is talking about what you're supposed to do when somebody else does you injury. And you say, what's this got to do with marriage? A great deal. If you will think very carefully, there have been days when you have looked upon your marriage mate as your enemy. And you said to yourself, it seems like she's just trying to do me in. Or it looks like he's just trying to destroy me here. And you're not feeling a bit positive about this other individual. You're not feeling friendly toward this other individual. You're not feeling warm and affectionate toward this other individual. In fact, you begin to feel like, this is the worst adversary I've got. And oftentimes that sort of line is taken by people in marriage counseling when they say, well now, you've got to understand that this mate of mine is really the bane of my life, and my life is wretched because of her or him. And the answer to that is what the Lord said. Love your what? Love your enemies. I think the rule is, you shall love your neighbor and hate your wife or your husband. You know, that it seems to be all right in this category. And it's not all right. This principle applies to the marriage relationship if it applies to any relationship at all. So, selfless love. Love that does not depend on what the other person does. Is that not the kind of love we have received? Marriage will be built on the rock when it's built upon a selfless love that does not depend upon the behavior of the other person, but comes out of our determination to be and to do what we have been called upon to be and to do because we're Christians. While we're at that point, I want to tell you, that's the reason we need to marry a Christian. And it's more than that. That's the reason we need to marry a Christian who is purely and earnestly and totally devoted to serving Christ. Because you're going to need this kind of love in this marriage relationship. And you're going to need it from your marriage mate, because I know, perfect as you are, you're liable to do a few things that are not exactly in the best interest of the other person. And some time, you're going to have to love somebody that's not loved. And if you don't find the strength to do that, your marriage is not likely to survive in any kind of loving or good way. And more than that, you will have failed to be a Christian. Quickly then, chapter 6 deals with hypocrisy. What you do on stage. And sometimes that's the way we are in a marriage relationship. We're one way at the meeting house, another thing at home. One way when we're at home, another way when we're on vacation, playing some little game that the Lord does not approve. Hypocrisy is like lying. It's like dishonesty. Chapter 7 begins with a discussion of hypocritical, caustic, critical attitudes that sometimes we develop. We try to work on the other person with our petty criticisms. I want to tell you something. I learn everything the hard way, almost. Sometimes I'm wise enough to get it the easier way, but that does not work. You keep on trying to whittle on this marriage mate, you know, just a little tweak here or there, just a little fine tuning, and you'll be just wonderful. And then somebody starts working on you. And then you start working on each other. And before this is all over, it turns into a massacre. You can't do that. You cannot try to reconstruct your marriage mate, because it does not work. And especially you can't do it when your own faults stick out like some wart. The first thing you do is say, I'm not a perfect husband. Let me just say that. I am not a perfect husband. I'm a better husband than I used to be. And I needed to make those improvements. And I'm still trying to grow as a husband. But I did that by facing up to the fact that I surely was far from being a perfect husband. A long way from being a perfect husband. And I started working on myself. Let me tell you, the way to change your wife, your husband, is to change yourself. And then when you change yourself and your reactions and attitude toward them are totally different, when they're like the Lord's and as the Lord wants yours to be in all relationships, when that happens, then the marriage relationship, like any relationship, is going to be improved radically. But we don't learn too easily. We still go back. Oh, why don't you do this? And why don't you do that? Why do you leave all your clothes and laying all over the place? It's terrible. Well, my wife solved that problem. She just left the clothes lying all over the place. Well, I finally got tired of that and decided I better pick them up because nobody else is going to pick them up. Wise woman. She wasn't retaliating. She was just helping me see. We have to serve one another. Isn't that the idea of our lives? To serve someone else. And husbands need to serve wives. Wives need to serve husbands. And they'll be so busy serving each other that they won't have time to think about how they're not getting served some way or another. And even when you're not being served, you must serve too. You must serve anyway. Even as the Lord served us. Well, as I said, I didn't know this Sermon on the Mount was about marriage. Well, it is. Because it's about everything, everywhere. this sermon is. It doesn't leave anything out. The great thing about worshiping Christ is we worship the wholeness of God with the wholeness of our own hearts and the wholeness of our lives. So, when there's trouble in the home, let me tell you what the problem is. Sin. Sin born of selfishness, sin born of lust, sin born of pride, whatever the driving force may be, it's sinful, it's wicked, and the thing is, it won't just lose you a happy home, which it will certainly do. It will lose you your right to heaven. That's the thing that ought to get our attention every now and then. Even if your home is not happy, that's not the end of the problem. But let me just say this. Even if all your efforts do not create a happy home because of the disposition you've made, it's better to go on living a godly life and secure the true happiness in the world to come than to turn into the very disposition that you are receiving. There are a lot of forces assailing home today. The storms are blowing. And you're encouraged to think about yourself. Think about how you are unfulfilled. Think about how your dreams have been shattered. And before you're through thinking about yourself, you're going to really be in a self-righteous, self-focused stew that is going to make you a horrific person to live with. And therefore, you will have added immeasurably to the sad tragedy that has already begun. Don't do that. What is the secret of happiness in a relationship? Being a Christian. Being a true Christian. Being a Christian who loves others, not because they love them, but because God has put into us, by His own gracious, selfless love, the disposition to do the same because we want to be like Him. Marriage is serious business. You enter into this relationship which is so intimate and so close, which brings children into the world. And I can tell you, as Jesus has said in this sermon, that to do that badly, well, it will cost you your life, your essential life. And we're going to sing this invitation hymn. I want to give back the 5 minutes of technological interference. I want you to think, young people, you are just beginning this adventure. Learn to be a selfless person. Learn to be like the Lord. And for those who are already in it a while, and it's astonishing sometimes to me to find out the problems of some couples who are both Christians are happy. And what is required is repentance. And somebody says, before you got those words out of your mouth, "Oh, I will if they will. I will if they will." What's that got to do with anything? This is your soul. This is your life that you're talking about. This is who you are that you're talking about. Is what I'm to do dependent upon what somebody else does? I will tell you this much. If the Lord God Almighty had been waiting on us to do something so He could do something, He would never have had the privilege. For He had never sent His Son into this world. And so we have learned a lesson from Him. So, awaken that keen conscience. Learn to get on your knees and ask for forgiveness from God. And then learn to beg and plead with your mate to forgive you as well. Learn to confess your transgressions. Learn to resolve in your heart on the basis of that humble spirit that you're going to make corrections. Listen, the world will be transformed by that. Your world will be transformed by it. And besides all that, you get heaven. So, if you're not a Christian tonight, you're ill-prepared to be husband or wife. And if you are a Christian and things are not going too well, and I just call on you to say, "I'm taking care of my part. I'm taking care of my part, and I'm going to do it directly." I don't know if any of this requires you to come forward. You'd know about that. Most of these things happen in the quiet or disturbed atmosphere of the home. But you know what you need to do. We're going to stand and sing this hymn. And we invite all those who have never confessed Jesus as Lord, as did our dear Noelia recently, so boldly confess her faith, that you come and confess yours and be baptized into Christ. And if you have sinned in ways that go beyond just your private activity, then correct it as widely as it has happened. And take our brother Wayne's example that stirred us all this morning as a pattern for yourself. While we're standing.